you know, we've had those scenarios where they said, hey, you've been in this program for 2 years and we still see this low risk, but let's run the blood test. And it showed an elevated probability. They intervened and it was an early stage cancer. So they were just waiting for that cancer, right, to evolve, to grow. When you empower a physician with those patients' test results, you really are playing a pretty pivotal role in their treatment going forward.
This is the ProCo 360 podcast for people who love Colorado and love hearing from Colorado's most inventive and successful entrepreneurs. I'm Dave Tabor, and this episode is with Scott Hutton, CEO of Biodesix, a company transforming personalized diagnostics and accelerating precision medicine. Biodesix Lung Notify is a fascinating test that helps patients and doctors identify illness and make smart decisions about optimal treatment options. I'm looking forward to talking to Scott about how that works and about running a publicly traded biotech company that's expanding while still seeking profitability. Scott, glad you're here on ProCo 360.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Now, I gave you kind of an overview of Biodesix. You can probably give us a better one.
Yeah. So Biodesix, we're headquartered in Louisville, Colorado, just outside of Boulder. Happy to be a Colorado-based company. We were founded in 2006, really with the focus of helping patients with cancer, and it was that broad. Where we really refined our approach was focusing on lung cancer. Lung cancer still is the deadliest of all cancers. More people will die of lung cancer than breast, prostate, and colon combined this year. So, you know, we had an opportunity to discover and develop a few tests that we've commercialized. And those in partnership with pulmonologists around the United States, we're applying those to positively impact patient care.
Yeah, you know, I'm really fascinated about, you know, how transferable some of these technologies are. But first, I want to dig more into the actual product called Notify Lung. And it delivers results that are essentially probabilities that doctors and patients can use to make treatment decisions. So explain how those probabilities work.
Yeah, so there's two tests that make up the Notify testing strategy. One of those is a classic rule-in test. The other is a rule-out test. You're ruling in for cancer or ruling out for cancer. That's the simplest way to think about it. When a patient sees a physician, they immediately assign a risk of malignancy. And they'll use calculators, the patient's chart, kind of their gut and intuition based upon what they've seen throughout their practice. When they assign that risk of malignancy, it's never zero or 100. That's where our tests really provide great value. So you can take a patient that might have a 40% risk of malignancy where you say, gosh, 40%, that's not a lot, but it could be just enough. With our test result, we help reclassify that risk. So the goal is that with that rule-in test, you'll increase that probability. And if that happens, then the physician knows this patient has a malignancy. I should intervene. Or on the opposite extreme, if it decreases the risk, takes it from 40 down to, say, 10 to 15%, then the physician can say, hey, I can support you taking, you know, a wait and watch approach, and we'll follow up with a CT scan in a year or so.
Yeah. So why would, if there are these tests now available, why would anyone just ask their doctor for her or his guess?
You know, it's a great question. A lot of it's how physicians are trained. And so they go off of their training and then also different guidelines. And a lot of those guidelines are delayed in how often they're updated. And so they'll be updated not when a test is introduced, but when there's plenty of clinical data.
10 years of data
yes,
and so forth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in that interim, you've got to get out as a commercial team, and which is what we do, educate, you know, inform and empower those physicians to order your test, utilize those test results, and it helps build the clinical data.
So the reason I said is because it sounds like, I mean, you know, you hear these stories, you see these stories about, you know, drug reps out there pushing stuff, you know, I mean, what's the secret sauce in helping to explain, like, this is why you need this product and here's how it works before all the clinical data has amassed?
Yeah. You know, for us, where we start is we want to be consultative. We want to partner with those healthcare providers, making sure that they know where the problems are, and then let's be a solution provider and provide questions. You know, the questions they have, let's provide answers to those
questions. Do physicians like say, oh, so you can help me narrow my gut from 40% or 60% down to 10 or 90? Do they recognize that right away? Is this a hard thing to conceptualize?
No. They understand it. They definitely are more aware of, you know, diagnostic testing today, more so than ever. I think they have more questions on how, what's the workflow, what do the test results look like? That's where we spend a lot of time ensuring that those test results are informative for the patient if he or she sees it and it's intuitive what it says. And then for the healthcare professional team, they've got the data they need to personalize that patient's care.
Yeah. So here's what's been really eating at me is a curiosity. And that's this. I mean, the probability. So you go from somebody who's like, oh, you might have 40% chance of having cancer. Okay, now you've got a 10% chance of having cancer. That's good to know, I suppose. But in a world where physicians get sued for everything, where insurance companies push back against everything, I mean, does this data really shape the way patients are getting treated?
Yeah, it does. And maybe most importantly, it always should, right? I look at this as we're all patients of some sort. You've got to be your own personal advocate, right? You've got to ensure that you're asking the right questions, right? You're not just trusting what physicians and healthcare providers are suggesting to you. You're doing your research and coming in informed. And so that's what we see. I'll give an example. Let's say that there's a 60-year-old woman. They say, hey, you've got about a 40% risk of malignancy, but there's a known complication with that procedure, right? So if we're going to do a biopsy, that might be risky. Now, you want to make shared decision-making. So the healthcare professional will look at each patient a little different. What other comorbidities do you have? How old are you? Are you strong? Are you vibrant? Can you withstand this procedure? So it's not really about risk-taking. It's about personalizing that individual's care.
Yeah. You know, I know that's a popular notion that patients should have control of their own care. And to me, there's the opposite side. Like, I taught statistics in college as a TA, just as a TA. I wasn't really that good. And to me, and you and I were talking about autonomous vehicles before we started doing this, right?
Yeah.
And I'm a strong believer, as I shared, that autonomous vehicles, even though they're written up as sensationalized, they're still safer already. So I get back to this. People want what they want, regardless of whether it makes financial sense. Like, I have a 10% chance, and my chance of dying in a tissue sample or like 0.1, do it. I don't care what it costs. Just do it. I don't care what it costs. Like, so how do you manage this balance?
Yeah, so, and that's where our sales team really can be the most effective in having an individual conversation with that physician and his or her team to say, what are your questions? What are your concerns? One of the things we offer is a consultation where after they've ordered, 10 tests, 15, 20, whatever it is, we go back in and we show how decision making was changed. So part of it isn't assuming that they understand how it'll change. Let's just see how they adopt the test and then go back in and show them how it's informed and guided a change, a behavior change, then track it for another year and show how the outcomes have changed.
So over time, physicians can become better able to advise patients on, how probabilities actually impact their lives and the decisions that they want to make. It seems like it would also create, like, medicine is supposed to be like scientific, right? But it seems like it also, what you do creates a bit of room for creativity and treatment and opportunity, like, for judgment more so than otherwise.
Yeah. Even in looking at those guidelines I referenced, it actually uses the phrase physician judgment. And so, you never want to take away from a practicing physician. They're the ones that are making the difficult decisions. They're the ones talking to the patients. So our job really is to give them more tools to help enable them to make better decisions, to be accurate, and provide the data and whether it's the biostatistics or the science behind it to support the decision making.
That makes a lot of sense, because ultimately, like, I'm such a cynic when it comes to healthcare, forgive me, but people want what they want. They just want what they want. And in our country, we've got government officials giving people what they want and mandating that everybody get everything. So how do you explain, like, okay, is your test something that they're going to pay for and then they're going to do whatever they want anyway? Or is this the idea that over time, we're going to help people learn to make smarter, better decisions about their care?
That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate goal. We'll get there. Some physician practices welcome it more. We make a lot more progress early on. Others, they're laggards in bringing on new technology. That's where data is really helpful.
Hmm. Do you find that there's a that there's a mindset or a group of physicians that you can target, like almost a psychometric, a mental mindset that you can target to help find the physicians that are likely to help this process along?
Yeah.
I would psychographic. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I would say yes. There's always early adopters, people that are a little more willing to bring on new technologies, yeah. Right? You talking about an autonomous car, you know, I would say you're an early adopter, right? You would take that on. You can find them. Where we have the greatest benefit, and I think it speaks volumes, physicians listen to other physicians more so. And so we have a number of physicians that will do kind of peer-to-peer educational events for us.
Yeah.
That carries way more weight where a physician can say, hey, this was my experience before, this is my experience after.
Yeah.
And here's how my patient care has changed. And then another physician, you know, they can have that dialogue that I can't have with them because I'm not a physician.
Yeah. And I could see that over time, ultimately, good physicians want better data to make better advice.
Yeah. You know, pay for performance is something, I mean, I look at, we all are in those, you know, scenarios, right? In our work on a daily basis, if we're not performing well, it will impact pay. Physicians have been, you know, challenged with that for years. And so the more that is adopted, the more physicians are going to look to utilize these tools and resources to make them more effective.
Yeah. And I can see, I mean, I by the way, I know I've pushed back on this, but I think it's an amazing technology where you can help people see, even if the choices are difficult.
Yeah.
Like, you know, going from a 40% chance now to a 20% chance of it being malignant, I still have to make a choice.
You do. You do. And that physician can help where they can say, hey, I've seen others, you know, that are just like you.
We've
taken this approach and it's worked out. But they're also not being lost, right? I think that's something else to think about.
So if I was
not going to intervene on that patient as a physician, I can always say, hey, come back in 6 months. Let's do another CT scan. Let's see if something's changed. Come back in 6 months. Let's do another blood draw. Let's run this test again. So you can continue to use the information, the test is providing to alter. And so if there was a patient that just said, hey, I'm resistant to this, we're not going to do this procedure, okay, let's have a scheduled follow-up that's already on the calendar and let's monitor this. You know, in cancer, monitoring and surveilling is key, right? You're monitoring for disease progression and or recurrence at all times, right? Mm-hmm. You're really looking to see what's changing in that patient's scenario.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, so can you think of a couple of specific examples where this has been put into place that you mentioned sort of an arbitrary patient who 40%, but I mean, can you think of a couple of examples at both ends of this that you've used the test? And
You know, that scenario I just gave where you said maybe a patient that's in a surveillance program and coming back for an annual CT, you know, we've had those scenarios where they said, hey, you've been in this program for 2 years and we still see this low risk, but let's run the blood test, and it showed an elevated probability. They intervened, and it was an early stage cancer.
Yeah.
So they were just waiting for that cancer, right, to evolve, to grow.
To become a higher risk.
Yep. Huh. And so we were able to identify that sooner, and they could pull that patient forward. And on the opposite extreme, we've seen it where a physician will say, hey, before running your test, I saw this individual. I was certain they had all of the indications that it was going to be a malignancy. Ran your test. You know, it lowered the probability, but I went ahead and intervened. And guess what? Your test was right.
Huh.
So, you know, it's not really about right or wrong. And that's where we look at ourselves as a tool to help physicians make better decisions.
Yeah. But over time, they get to see what I would have done and what the outcome was over time, right? This is a great – hey, I'm going to take a quick break. Listeners, this is ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast of the last 3 years. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and this is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado businesses and entrepreneurs. My guest today is Scott Hutton, CEO of Biodesix. Thanks to sponsors Kinsley Meetings, and Kinsley Meetings is our longest-running sponsor. Really appreciate them. Their business is growing based on a great reputation for planning and conducting meetings with lots of variables. Also, Via Technologies, thanks to those guys for hosting ProCo 360 and all the great help the team gives me around managing the site, Colorado Business Magazine and ProCo 360 partner to build our audiences, and Denver Angels is a partner. We feature some great Colorado companies together on ProCo 360. Go to ProCo360.com and check out the sponsors. All right, now I want to ask this question I've been wondering about, because it seems like I really like, at least what I'm learning about Biodesics, the idea of helping patients and physicians get better at predicting outcomes and then making smart choices. So could you just flip a switch and say, okay, we just solved cancer. Well, we not solved, but you know, we've created this effective testing for lung cancer. Now let's flip the switch and it'll be good for this cancer, that cancer.
Yeah. You know, it's a great question. Unfortunately, what's, you know, the science and biology will tell us is different cancer types function differently. You know, the different proteins, different genes in abundance, they shed at different rates. So there really isn't a single technology that you can apply to multiple cancers. It would be more about discovering, developing, and commercializing individual tests that would be applicable to, you know, circulating DNA, right, that is specific to that tumor type. For us, you know, we've seen some of our research carry over to, you know, two or three different cancer types. But we really haven't seen something that works across the board. And there's a number of other companies that continue to conduct research in that space. A lot of them are focusing on what they call an MCED. It's a multi-cancer early detection. And that's really simple blood draw that can give you insights across a ton of cancers. But what you find is by the different disease state, they have different probabilities of success.
Yeah. So I guess in my mind, my unscientific mind, I mean, if you were to say, okay, we've got Nodify Lung and that works, is 10% of your technology applicable to creating something else? Can you get a running start? 20%? I mean, can you use what you do to get a running start on the next one?
Definitely. I think success breeds success. And so when I think of our laboratory and discovery and development teams, right, as they have success, they're applying the learnings that they have towards discovery and development of other tests. Also, we have a biopharmaceutical partnership side of the business where we'll partner with biopharmaceutical companies that are trying to ensure they understand how their drug in the development phase is working. We have access to those insights that can help inform us too. So we really are trying to, you know, let's try to get smarter each and every day.
Yeah.
And as we do, apply what we've learned. And I think what you can see is you see an abundance of technologies that are used over and over because of the success they've had.
So pieces, components in the design of these processes are used in multiple ways.
Yeah, they could be a constant or similar.
Huh. So that helps.
It does.
And, you know, thinking back on Nodify Lung, how long did it take to become a product that you're actually using?
You know, it's a great question. Every test that is discovered and developed has, you know, a unique timeline.
Yeah.
And that could be a function of what's the disease state, how you know, what's the prevalence? Are we getting access to samples and can we discover and develop at a fast rate? Then you also have to validate it. And so what's the size of the clinical trial?
Right.
You know, when we've looked at it, you know, you're on this 3 to 5 year kind of time horizon, no matter what you do, you can't really circumvent that.
Yeah,
and I think that's a great thing for, you know, advocating
safety
for patients
because
regulatory bodies are going to look at that. They want to see a large N, you know, statistically, they want to make certain that they understand how it's performing in the broadest use possible.
Although your product, and by the way, so 3 to 5 years to get to a point where you can put a label on the package and say it's ready to go.
Yeah, and that gets you through approval. Now, reimbursement and coverage with payers is a completely different kind of time frame that you have to consider. Some of that can occur concurrently, but oftentimes those same payers, they want to see those results of those studies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that 3 to 5 year timeline is one where you say, I can go from discovery, develop something, validate it, and maybe have a product that I can have commercially available, but the odds of it being fully reimbursed at that time frame are really slim.
So what did it cost?
You know, we've not disclosed what it cost. The best part about us having 5 on-market tests is those synergies you're talking about. And so, you know, when you develop more than one test, you can save a little bit here and there. There's been a lot of research recently that's been conducted that has come out and said that a diagnostic test is going to cost probably about $75 million on average
to
get it to where you're commercializing it. then you still have to continue to develop data on top of that. Yeah. So I look at it and say some tests, especially those that are really complex, high value add, they're probably going to be closer to $100 million and on that 5 to 7 year time frame.
Hmm. So 5 years-ish, $75 to $100 million-ish. What does that look like in a lab, like for a layperson? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, and you just expanded to a larger headquarters now. So what does this whole infrastructure look like to get this done?
You know, so you referenced the new facility. We're so excited to be in our new 80,000 square foot facility in Louisville, Colorado. Because that was built fit for purpose, we were able to take exactly what you're talking about into mind and really work from a early design phase to build a laboratory that not only allows us to discover and develop today, it also allows us to run the patient samples that are so critical.
Yeah.
We can also expand. And so we can bring on additional equipment, additional lines. We've got room to bring on partnerships. But when you talk about what a fully integrated business looks like, these are where there's significant barriers to entry. First, the biggest barrier would be the cost and the time. But once you've built it, now you've got teams that are, a ton of PhDs and researchers that sit there, and this is what they've conducted their life's work to do. We're just building on that.
Yeah, how many people are in there working?
Yeah, so our Louisville facility, we've got right at 100 people.
So I'm thinking, like, all I can reflect back on is, like, my high school chem lab, you know? And I'm thinking, 80,000 square feet, how many Petri dishes, microscopes, people? Like, right, I don't – how come it's so big?
Well,
what else?
Yeah. A lot of the equipment's big, right? So you look at some of the equipment is large.
Like, what is it? What is a big piece of equipment doing?
Well, they're running samples. And so it depends. So you got to think these pieces of equipment, some are small, some are large, but they've got their own computer units inside of them, their processors inside of them. They're distilling down all the data when they run the sample. And so for us, it's benchtop. So what you talk about when you think of like a chemistry class, we have that. But we wanted to ensure in this space, not only could we grow, but from a, recruiting and retention, we want our laboratory team to have space. We wanted it to be world class. And so we did some things that weren't traditional in giving them space, giving them room to grow. And then we've got rooms that are just meant for research and discovery. They're like science experiments. Go in there and explore and challenge your creative mind and come up with new things. But we are regulated, and so when we look at it, it's a pretty well-defined process from receiving a patient sample, that blood sample, then is accessioned, and it works through kind of the workflow and runs through the equipment so that at the end of this, think of it as an assembly line process, then the patient's result comes out, and we can send that electronically.
So you process all of it in the lab, too.
Yep.
All right. So you're not just producing the – well, actually, you're not producing a test, really.
No.
You're taking – in fact, is that
– it's data. Think of it in terms of data.
Does that speed the process of approval? And I want to talk about financial stuff in a minute, but when I think about it, you're taking something out of the patient. You're not doing something into the patient. You're not having them ingest a drug. So does that speed the process of getting a product to the market?
Not really. I think the regulatory bodies are looking at it in terms of, first, do no harm. But then second of all, what are you trying to do? And so we'll spend a lot more time with them going through the methods, the mechanism, the data, the results to verify and validate that this is reproducible and that the test results are accurate.
Huh. I would have guessed, obviously, because of the question, that if you're not like giving somebody a drug, you're actually taking blood out and doing a test, that it would be easier to get things through the process. It might be quicker because you're not hurting a patient.
Yeah. Yeah.
Potentially.
It's the risk of hurting a patient.
Yeah.
I think biopharmaceutical has a pretty well-defined timeline. Those are lengthier, but that's a lot of that is based upon getting through a phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 clinical trial and then tracking those patients long-term. We're not tracking the patients long term because we're helping guide a treatment. So you're not looking for
three, four, five.
Yeah, we'll track 1, 2, 3 years. What ended up happening? Was that a cancer? Did they have a recurrence? We track all of that. But as part of an FDA approval, if you're going in and removing the cancer and it was proven to be cancer, the guidelines actually state that a surgical resection is deemed curative because you've removed it. But you immediately start a new cycle, which is a surveillance and monitoring phase to see if there's a recurrence.
Does that reflect on your test?
No.
Okay, I wouldn't think so. But
No. Our test is really, we're more or less guiding towards, do you have a malignancy or not, changing that risk. And then they intervene.
Yeah.
And when they intervene, that's when they confirm whether it actually was or not. Yeah. And it verifies and validates that our test results were accurate.
Yeah. So do you keep like a batting average?
No. No. You know, I think that's the one thing is we're always trying to get better. There's no such thing as a perfect test where you say there's 100%.
Yeah.
Patients are dealing with a lot, right? There's comorbidities. There's a lot of different things at play. And so for us, we want to get better. You know, we're striving to ensure that we can increase the test performance on all of our tests. And that's also what those research teams do, is they're continuously looking at new science and saying, hey, can we apply that to what we have today?
Yeah.
And it makes us better.
Because then your statistical probabilities become narrowed and narrowed and narrowed, where you're closer and closer to being right.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about the money.
Yeah.
Because all of this, listeners, all of this is happening within the context of a public company. You just released your earnings, and last quarter your revenue was almost $15 million, which is a lot of growth, 64% growth. Gross profit was 79%, and you had a net loss almost as much as your revenue. Now, I know there's depreciation, all that stuff, but like, how the hell? Like, I don't get it. You know, you can have massive gross margins and lose tons of money, and here we are talking and laughing. Like, how does this all work?
Yeah. So one of the things that we also just completed a fundraise, a $55 million
fundraise. Oh, well, that helps.
And as we completed that fundraise, the use of proceeds were continue to expand the sales force, which helps grow that top line.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, we stated, hey, we're going to get to profitability. We were able to disclose that not only is that our goal, but if you look at that adjusted EBITDA over time, it's come down significantly. And so I think most everybody's triangulating on the second half of 2025 as the sweet spot for when we get to profitability. Going back to what you said earlier, you know, $50, $75, $100 million in, you've got to build out that infrastructure.
Yeah.
And you've got to keep those teams busy. And as you do so and build it, you can get there. But that's difficult. A lot of early biotech companies really struggle with that. And we're fortunate here to have had the opportunity to commercialize 5 tests that all have Medicare coverage, all are reimbursed with private payers at differing levels. So we're getting closer each and every quarter because of scale.
So now becomes where once physicians begin to accept and adopt and you reach that critical mass, now you become a profitable company.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. And investors, did Wall Street investors understand that?
Yeah. Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah. You know, so pre-pandemic, you didn't get that inquiry much. It was just, is the science good? Let's innovate. Let's move fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pandemic created a lot of scenario where you have to get to profitability sooner.
Yeah,
right? You've got to be able to sustain that growth. So for us, that has changed. All of our peer group companies in the diagnostic space are focused on that real goal.
Achieving profitability at some point soon.
And we all were.
Yeah.
Right. But it was probably on a lengthier time time horizon. Mm-hmm. So it was, how do you pull this forward? And it's a balance, right? You've got to invest enough to grow and scale the business, but you got to be mindful on the return of every dollar spent.
Well, you've got two pulls for revenue. One is to expand, as you said, the sales team expands. You've also, you got to keep spending money in R&D, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
I would say you do, but we were very honest and said, hey, we're gonna scale back a little bit. We're going to continue to spend money on R&D. Some of the products we have in our product development pipeline, at one point in time, I think some thought we could have commercialized those as soon as 2025. Hmm. And we've now said that's not going to happen, because we don't want to delay getting to profitability.
It's this awkward dance, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think as you get closer to profitability, hopefully there's more optionality. And then you can be selective and say, hey, we might invest in one of these programs to start pulling it forward.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's what we worry about as an industry, is you don't want to slow innovation, right? We know what we're doing will have a positive impact in patients' lives. And so anything that slows or delays that, we take it personal.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions about the financial piece. But first, reminding listeners, this is ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast of the last 3 years. I'm Dave Tabor, and this is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado businesses and entrepreneurs. My guest today, Scott Hutton, CEO of Biodesix. Go to ProCo360.com to subscribe to the newsletter, read my blog, link to sponsors, and catch the books I'm listening to on Audible. I did have a question, too, about mission and profit as it relates to culture internally. You know, you've got scientists who just want to innovate. You know, you got people who want to do good in the world, and here you are answering quarterly earnings calls. How does that jive?
you know, for us, what we do is really fulfilling. And I think that's the common thread when you look at all the Biodesics teammates. You know, we really do look at it in terms of if we can positively impact one individual patient's life on a daily basis, that's enriching, right? That is fulfilling. And we can do it on a broader scale now that we've grown and have five on market tests. So we celebrate those wins, right? It's when you empower a physician with those patients' test results, you really are playing a pretty pivotal role in their treatment going forward. Hopefully, the broader our sales force goes and expands, and the deeper we go, maybe we can get to earlier detection, earlier diagnosis. We know in cancer, earlier detection and diagnosis increases the likelihood of a positive outcome. That's what our team focuses on. You know, the other thing we focus on is clear and concise communication within the team, helping them understand, yeah, we aren't profitable. What does that timing look like? Why does it look that way? It actually facilitates a culture where the team is really accountable. Hmm. You know, they challenge themselves. If we're going to spend a dollar today, is this the best way we should spend it? And do we get the return that we need? And so I think having a small team that's grown and expanded a lot over the last 3 to 4 years, none of that's changed in our culture. Patient will always be first. Each and everything we do has to have that impact. And I think as fulfilling as that is, it helps justify when team members come together and say, hey, I've got three different ideas. Which one of these can we invest in? Mm. We really do look at it and say, hey, how broad is that impact?
That's cool. You're Colorado based. You're chosen to expand in Colorado. What's the story with that?
Well, you know, you said it for listeners that are proud to be, you know, residents in Colorado. I would say the majority of the Biodesics team fits right into that, myself included. I've lived in Colorado now almost 17 years. Two of my three kids are, you know, this is all they really know. My youngest was born here. So obviously for her, she's a native. This is home. And I think many of our Biodesics team members feel the same way. Whether we came here on our own choice or you know, the science and brought us here, we're grateful to be here. I think how can you not like the lifestyle, the weather? And we find it as a huge recruiting tool. I know others may talk about it can be difficult because there isn't an abundance of scientists to pull from.
Yeah.
I look at it a little bit differently, and I say that, you know, hey, especially now, we're coming out of a pandemic where more and more people made decisions based upon what was, you know, higher quality of life or the best decision for their family. Yeah. I look at Colorado, and I think that's a solution for many. Let's create that opportunity to bring them here.
So do you see a lot of momentum then in your sector?
Yeah, we definitely do. You know, there's a lot of turbulence when you really look at it over time, whether companies have stayed here, they've been acquired, there's transitions.
Yeah.
But I think there's a groundswell of interest. I think there's a lot of different groups that are helping build that interest. And then there's companies like us. And, you know, we've said that we want to help be a kind of a beacon of light. We've invited people to the new facility. We want them to see that. We want them to understand what we do. And hopefully we can help build kind of a biotech or scientific community that can support a lot more innovation moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, it becomes this self-fulfilling kind of momentum building thing. More people come here. A few more people come here. Then more can look at Colorado and say, hey, I could bring my skill set here.
Yep.
And so last question, put on your futures hat. I just moderated a session on AI this morning. And I've been reading a lot about AI and its role in biotech development and so forth. What's your take on what role AI is going to play for Biodesics?
I think it's immense. We have used AI over the years, and some of our test discovery and development efforts have utilized AI.
Hmm.
So going forward, I think the key question is how do you commercialize that? How do you leverage it and scale it? How do you make it reproducible? It makes a ton of sense when you're dealing with large data sets, right? But you start to look at it and say, there's a means by which we can actually advance personalized care. One of us will be different.
Do you see feeding thousands of patients' data into an AI model and actually having AI tell you how to improve your test?
Yeah, I think you could look at it even from a physician. I think physicians are probably creating and or considering scenarios where that similar data is going to be presented to them. Hmm. And it says, hey, a like patient, you know, we've studied this, treat them this way. So we're just going to have access to more information. It should make us more effective, more efficient. When it comes to test discovery and development, there's no doubt that it will. We've just got to continue to learn how to best utilize it and scale it. I'm like you. I love embracing new technologies. I'm a big believer in it. And I think the Biodesix team, especially as curious and creative as we are, we're going to bring in as many technologies as we can that not only differentiate us, but just make us better.
Yeah. So you and I are going to take a autonomous vehicle ride sometime soon.
That's right. I hope so. Yeah.
Good. Hey, let's wrap up with that. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. Today on ProCo 360, you've been listening to my conversation with Scott Hutton, CEO of Biodesix. Scott, cool conversation. I learned a ton about biotech.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. It's been an honor to be here with you and really appreciate this opportunity. Look forward to seeing you up in our new facility soon.
I will be there. And listeners, glad you're here on ProCo 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCo 360 podcast. If you haven't yet, it's a huge help if you submit a review in your app. Thanks again to show sponsors Via Technologies, Kinsley Meetings, Denver Angels, and Colorado Biz Magazine. That's the show. Live, work, love Colorado.